Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi everybody, before we get into the podcast here, just to let you know, we are back in Cork's Opera House on August the 22nd to open the Cork Podcast Festival.
Which is an absolute honour, and myself and James are thrilled to be a part of such a great night, particularly when you have so many fantastic podcasts coming from Cork on the night and the week as well.
Yeah, no, listen, it's great to be part of the podcast scene. And we've a great guest on the night too, a friend of ours, Brezzy, a mental health advocate who's got a great story. Among other things, he's played Munster or rugby with Leinster, and he had a panic attack live on TV, and he does his own show now around his own journey. So it's going to be powerful.
Yeah, he's just going to talk about his story growing up and when it all started for him in relation to his mental health, and how he came through it, and what he does today around it. No, he does a lot of work within schools today and helps children to be able to cope much, much better with their own mental health. And he creates programs and stuff like that, and he does a lot of funding. So it should be a fantastic night.
Yeah, we'll have a bit of entertainment, a bit of music and a bit of a crack as well. So I hope to see you there August the 22nd. Tickets available at ticketmaster.ie or Cork Opera House box office. Thank you and enjoy the podcast. Hello everybody and welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I'm your host James and I'm joined as always by my good friend Timmy Long.
Hi everyone.
We are up in Ballymun in the Axis Theatre recording a few podcasts.
Yeah, we've been here before as well and the lads were very kind to leave us stay again today, and we've a very special guest, James, haven't we?
Yeah, we have Dr. Brian Penny. I know you worked hard for that PhD, so it's appropriate that we do not give you the title, but it's a long time coming. We've been looking to get John for a long time, so great to have you here. How are you?
Great, great, really good. It's a delight to be here. Great having a chat. I've been dying to meet you for a long, long time now at this stage. It has been a long time coming. Yeah. But yeah, really good, really good. Yeah. Keeping well.
You've a similar story to ourselves. You're in recovery and then you went down the education route, helped rebuild your life. So before we get into the neuroscience, because that was your area of study, do you want to take us back to where you grew up, what family life was like, what your childhood was like?
Yeah, God, every addiction story always starts in childhood, doesn't it? It's an interesting one. And I often say, like, my story of addiction started from the moment I was born. So I came into the world with a condition known as intestinal malrotation, which literally meant that my guts were twisted and I was getting very, very little nutrition into my body. So to cut a long story short, I basically had an operation without a general anaesthetic. This was sort of based on very weak medical evidence pre-1985. This is what they'd done with infants. And it's interesting, I've actually met several people in addiction that had an operation as an infant. And although I obviously didn't cognitively remember the operation, I don't remember it. It's like that trauma, the body keeps the score. It's like a set an imprint in me. And I had complications from that surgery. So for the first year of my life, I literally cried every single day without the proper pain med. And I genuinely believe, fiercely believe, that that just set me up as a finely tuned anxiety machine. And as I grew up in childhood, I was just hyper vigilant, always looking around, worrying about the future, agitated, tense. And I lived in an area where there was lots of drugs, lots of violence. Lovely area, great area in fairness, like some great people in it, but just very challenged area. And I was always going to take drugs. That's what people done, but I thought it was too smart to get addicted. But because of my past trauma and the challenges that I faced, when I started doing drugs, it just filled looked like, it felt like it filled a hole in my soul. It obviously wasn't filling the hole, but it just gave me a sense of peace that I'd never experienced before, and it just really grabbed me in from there.
You know, from doing all the academic stuff later on in life, just bringing it back, from doing all the academic stuff and looking at how the body, the biology of the body and the mind and the connection and the whole lot and the trauma, did all that stuff from childhood then start making sense to you later on in life when you were able to look back and, yeah, and understand that's why you became addicted?
Yeah, 100%. And it was only when I was writing the book. So I wrote my book in 2020 and I was doing a lot of research around writing the book. And I always knew I had that operation and I always knew I had those early traumas, but I never really completely related them to that. And it was only when I was looking at the research of trauma, like basically when we're traumatized, it's the fear center of our brains literally lighten up and it leaves an imprint. So it's basically, it's a learning experience. It's your body and your brain doing a good job. So the trauma is basically a message to the body that this could happen again. So we are going to keep you on hyper alert to protect you in the future. But it's not going to happen again. We live in a different world today where it's our evolution and how our bodies were designed prepared us for the world thousands and thousands of years ago. But in the world we live in today, all of the other challenges were seen as potential traumas. And that's what had just set me up. And I was just always anxious, always agitated, always worrying about my family dying. And these simple little things, I was on my way over here today and I was sort of processing and reflecting on what we might talk about today. And a memory popped up into my head of my dad being a vigilante. And I remember when we moved to Blanchardstown when I was about 7 years of age, it was a memory of mine, my dad going out being a vigilante. I didn't know what he was doing. I think he was fighting the younger people of the area or protecting the area. And I was just absolutely petrified. My dad's going to die. And I was just afraid everyone around me was going to die, that I was going to die. And it all came from that earlier trauma that just set me up for this red alert system where I was just constantly in a mode of fright and panic.
You mentioned The Body Keeps the Score, which is the title of a great book.
Bessel van der Kolk, yeah.
And we did a podcast of Bessel van der Kolk.
Wow.
Yeah, if people want to watch that on YouTube or listen on Spotify. But
I know.
One of the things he said to us on the podcast was, trauma is not what happened, chat. He says it's what happens inside you,
yeah,
when an event occurs. Some people can look at Timmy's story or all of my own and saying, well, I didn't have that, so I should be okay. But it's not like... people can have a trauma. It's not about the event.
Yeah.
Because like, even in families, like children can have a different mother.
Yeah.
Because they all experience that woman differently because she responds to them differently. So it's like, and because different personalities and different sensitivities, if me and Timmy come across a violent scene, I might be traumatized from it. He might take it in his stride.
Yes. Yeah.
Or if we come across an animal being hurt, I might take it in my stride. He might be trauma. So it's not the actual event. It's what happens inside. Yeah.
How we internalize that event and then how we fuel that event. Like something mightn't faze somebody, but then it's like a little wound and you can keep on opening that wound by thinking about that and reliving that event in a certain way. It's trauma is really interesting, but I love that angle. It's how we internalize it.
Yeah, and there's another factor as well. It's, you know, when we're young, we don't know how to be able to process stuff. You know, when emotional stuff comes up for us, stuff that we get hurt with, we're not able to process it because we don't understand how to do it. You know, particularly if you're cut off anyway. But when you do be able to learn it, like later on in life when I stopped using alcohol and drugs and I started doing a lot of personal development myself, I started to do some form of meditation where I was going back into the early childhood, young adult, and I was going back in there. And what I was doing is what was actually happening for me back then was when I was visualizing my young self, a really, really traumatized kid, completely cut off, completely introverted, cut off from emotions, I went back and I came across this child that just rebelled against everything. It would hit me, beat me, kick me, push me. It just had no trust for any form of human being. And after a time, I kept going back and leaving them know I was there during the meditation and stuff would come up. And this is what I was doing. I, as an adult, know how to process stuff when it comes up. Okay. And what I was doing was going back to that young child and showing him how to process, being there for him and showing him how to process this stuff, how to feel it,
telling him it's okay, because I didn't have that as a young child.
Yeah.
Telling him it's okay, I'm here for you. And after a while, after a few years, what started to happen was this young child wasn't running or kicking or anything. He'd come over, he'd see me, he'd play with me, he'd sit in my knee. And I know it might sound crazy to a lot of people, but if you look into it, it was all this childhood trauma. I was able to go back and able to heal this young child. And it's very, very doable. You know, it's very doable for people, but you have to understand it, and you have to be somebody who likes to meditate as well.
Yeah. I was exactly the same. So I done that inner child work as well, and I literally visualised and cradled that little kid. And I think when you think of trauma, there's no safety within your body. And if your body doesn't feel safe, nothing else is going to feel safe. Like, it's internalised, then becomes externalised pressure as well. And I literally, again, I just said, I'm safe. I have you now. So I visualised sitting with that little kid. And I had other traumas as well at 6 years of age and other ages. And I basically went back and visited that little kid, put my arm around him and says, I have you now, everything's okay, I've got your back.
Yeah.
And it's like reframing those earlier memories just makes a huge difference. Then when you recall them again, you're sort of, that's the healing process right there. Really powerful stuff.
And you can do it, sorry James, I'm just finishing this. You can do that. I was very hard on myself with a lot of stuff that I've done in addiction as well.
Yeah.
And I was starting to realise, like, I'm able to give this child that bit of love and care and try to love him and help him to get through this period. What I was doing was I was beating this guy up from my 20s to my 30s. I was slaughtering him, beating him up. But I wasn't beating him up. I was the one that was feeling it. So I started to understand, you have to go back here. And this fella didn't know any better either. He hadn't a clue. He was just doing what he thought he needed to do to cope in life.
Yeah.
And I started going back there. And you would not believe the amount of freedom I got from that. Going back and telling him, you know what, it's okay. It's okay, you didn't know any better. And I started giving him a bit of love. And I tell her, this guy was more lost than the child. And that's the truth.
Mad.
We did a podcast with a woman, Bridget, and she was consumed by fear, anxiety and stuff like that, but didn't know what happened or couldn't have no recollection of a traumatic event. But when she did some work then, it transpired that there was a very traumatic pregnancy and birth.
Wow.
And that was after emotionally scarring her, knockout. She wasn't conscious of it, but she was able to work through it then when she, you know, it was identified. But people might be listening to this now and they'd be saying, yeah, I can't remember anything, but I do have that feeling Brian is talking about.
Yeah.
But I can't remember anything, like the good childhood, but maybe it was before your memories, you know what I mean? But you could still work through that. It's not, you don't have to be able to remember the event to work through it. But what was it like for you in school? You're obviously very smart. Were you bright in school?
I was quite good in school. There was no exception. Like, when people sort of often relate a PhD with super smarts, that's just not the case. It's probably I would say my addiction nearly helped me, because it's about strategizing for a PhD. I made it about how I could make it easy because I was a little bit older, but it's about grit and determination as well. I think you mentioned hard work at the start when you said about the thing. There's definitely a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
But I was good in school. Even though I was worried a lot, I had a lot of anxiety, I was good in school. I had high hopes for myself. I really did have high hopes for myself. I was good at sport. I was really good at football. I was never going to make it as a footballer, but there was talk I might have gone and made it as a footballer. That was never really the truth in retrospect when I look back.
Mm.
But I had all of these high hopes. But once I found drugs, and I always remember, people often ask me, what was the gateway to drugs for me? And all of my friends had started smoking cigarettes at that stage. And I remember thinking, you're all stupid, smoking cigarettes, dirty smoke in your lungs, he is mad. And I was injured from football at the time. We were sitting on, we call them the gammers, they're like the green boxes for the football dressing rooms. We were sitting on top of them and the lads were smoking. I was only 14 years of age, and one of them says, the head buzz you get off that. And like a light bulb went off. I think it was the age I was at. Oh, I wouldn't smoke, but I like the sound of a head buzz. And it was a big, dirty Samson roll-up tobacco. And that was me first ever. But I loved the head buzz. And within weeks, I was smoking hash, taking tablets, blowing petrol in the fields. And it just escalated really quick because it gave me that relief away from that anxiety and that tormented mind, that compulsive thinking. And it just escalated very, very quickly, but still with this belief I'm going to become someone and I'd never be an addict, I'll never be like them. That was the thing, whatever them bloody well was. But it had me from that first moment. I just didn't know it. And it was just pulling me in slowly but surely all the time.
Do you know what you said earlier on? Your dad was involved in the vigilante group.
Yeah.
Was that against drug users, and would drugs be very frowned upon in your family?
Drugs would have been very frowned upon in my family, even though my mum and dad, like, made incredible people, like, have a great family, and yeah. The support system I had, I'm only realising, even in the last 2 years, how lucky I am with my family. I didn't realise actually when I got clean to start off with, but they had their own challenges with alcohol, and although drugs weren't in the family, alcohol played a role in the family as well. Now, I had a few traumas around that too, but my mum often says, like, she just thought we were too smart to do drugs, but she didn't have the education or the realisation that it's not about smarts. Trauma is the driver, you know, that way. And I imagine if I grew up in a very privileged area with plenty of money and no violence and drugs around, I'd have found another poison to heal that pain if the pain was there.
Or you would have experimented and moving on.
Moving on. You would have found a way, like, you know, that's the reality.
You said something there and it got me thinking about something in my own life. When I look at my own kids, I always think, do you know, we come where we live, like, there's a lot of drugs and everything that goes with that lifestyle. But myself and my wife, we've often sat at the table and we started to talk about the kids and just thinking, will they be okay as they're getting older and they're the kind of groups that they're starting to settle in with. And we say to each other, yeah, they'll be grand, you know, yeah. They're sensible, you know, they know what they have good awareness. But you said something there, like, it actually really doesn't matter where the awareness is there or not. It's really about if something has been challenging in their life and they haven't dealt with it or processed it, and they find drink or drugs, and it just takes the edge off of them. Could quite easily get addicted.
Yeah.
What would you say to a parent, maybe around something like that? How to be able to help them to deal with something, a child, no less, maybe experimenting.
Yeah, where I go to with that straight away is, right, there was a lot of us that tried heroin when we were younger. Like, it was a big gang of us, but only two of us got chronically addicted to it, and it was the two that struggled most with our emotions. So for me, I often say that, like, I obviously had a drug problem, but the drugs weren't their problem. Under the bonnet, it was an anxiety problem and it was a mental health problem. So what I would say is to parents is, don't be worrying about the drugs. They're going to be out there and your kids will come across them. It's about giving them the awareness, the education, but the coping tools to deal with our inner world emotionally and psychologically. So just focus on that and give them those tools, which is, it's really difficult. And I don't think it's all about, like, telling them how to be mindful and practicing mindfulness with them. It's not really about that. I think it's about giving them a language system, yeah, and helping them to process emotions, giving them the language around emotions, listening to your kids, because if you don't listen to your kids and you preach to your kids, well, guess what? They're not going to talk to you when they have a challenge. So it's listening to understand and trying to show empathy and perspective, because the development of kids is so different to adults, and we tend to suffer with the course of assumption and think they see the world similarly to us, but they're coming at it from different perspectives. So it's trying to jump into their shoes, be empathetic, and give them that foundational emotional health. So if drugs do come on the scene, they'll be impervious to it.
Great.
When we were driving up from Cork there a while ago, we were talking, we were reminiscing about the good old days or the bad old days.
The bad old days, but it is a mix all the time, isn't it? Yeah, because there's great crack within it as well, like, it has to be said.
But we were thinking about, like, talking about your feelings and emotions, it just wasn't done because there was no mental literacy, there was no emotional intelligence. And what we were talking about was, like, let's say if I'm a... I can remember a few times where I meet one of the boys, John Paul, Tommy, Damien, and, like, you could see they're down in themselves.
Yeah.
But all you knew was, like, come on, we go to the off license. Mm-hmm. Yeah, make a joint. That was your way of looking after them. Yeah. Or if I come down there, I could see my head, come on, I take you on, and you're going drinking for the night. But that, and, you know, some people look at people like that and say, he's a bad influence, but he's probably helping them in the best way he knows how.
Yeah.
Do you know, because we didn't have emotional intelligence, mental, we didn't have the language,
yeah,
we didn't know anything else. All we know is that we know how to get rid of that head.
Short term.
A few bags, a few cans,
yeah,
a bag of gear, a few tablets or a joint. That was all you had. And people look at drug pushers or people that's using drugs or they're bad influence on my kids. Maybe they're not bad influence on their kids. Maybe they're trying their best to help your kid in the best way they know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And do you know what I always say? Like, it's because I struggled with the book. Like, I do a lot of corporate work and I started saying, geez, what should I put into the book? And it was Lynn Rowan, who I know is a good friend of mine, a pal of yours, you had her on the podcast. She said, just speak your truth. So I just spoke my truth and I put it all in the book. And there was no stigma against that. I'm not too sure if they all read the book, to be quite honest, but like in terms of the corporate world, I'd never received stigma of that. But what I try to get across is that most drug pushers are drug users on another day. Like, to be one day, I'd be selling drugs that I come across 200 quid, so I'll buy a big bag of heroin, sell a few bags. The next time, next week, he'd be selling it to me. It's not this drug dealers and drug users. It's interactive and it's more nuanced than that. There's obviously the bigger drug dealers who are like bringing it in from the country, and that's a different element of it. But like, they're all helping each other.
Do you ever hear the tale of, or the drug dealer, they're giving out the drugs for free.
For free. Putting it in the letterbox and then they're addicted.
That literally never happened.
Never.
You never got fucking that.
Imagine a bag of heroin coming in a letterbox. She wouldn't know what to do with it.
It's a great marketing tool for it's a great marketing tool for some of these, you know, films that you see for drug dealers. Like,
I only came across that like, I hadn't heard it in a while, and someone had said it. I think it was somebody down in Cork, and he says, oh, they're all giving them all the drugs, and that's why. And as if the guy was horning and I didn't want to go against him, so I just started I just won't say it, but it's not the reality.
No, the reality is, like, if I was selling drugs, okay, and I had 10 bags of crack, I wouldn't be giving one of them bags away for nothing, because I wouldn't be fucking that. Do you know what I mean?
That's the reality.
That is the reality. When you're taking your own drugs, like, you say, why would I give it away when I can use it myself?
There's no long term thinking of building building a marketing campaign around.
I think it just looked right in film.
Yeah.
The drug dealers look at, like, in the bad. Listen, it's wrong to sell drugs as well. We'd have to be honest.
You know what I mean?
Because there's another side to selling drugs, that if the wrong person gets them at the wrong time, or a child gets their hands on them, or if someone drops the drugs and a child picks them up, like, the consequences there are probably fatal. Yeah. So it's not a great thing either. But listen, when you come from places we do, that is the reality of the story.
Do you remember in the 90s, during the rave scene, the ecstasy scene, there was a girl over in Essex, young girl, she took an E, but she kind of panicked. It wasn't the E that killed her, but, you know, during the rave scene, where ecstasy was always like, you have to hydrate yourself, you know?
Yeah.
But she panicked and she drank, like, way too much water and got fluid on the brain and passed away.
I've heard
but that effectively
that,
ended the 1990s rave scene and the ecstasy scene.
Wow.
And it brought a lot of heat on the dealers in Essex at the time, and a lot of heat on criminals in general in England. And that's how the Essex boys ended up getting taken out.
Okay.
Three been killed in a Range Rover.
Was that all?
Yeah. But like, what fucking huge diversion there.
Yeah.
just to show, like, you don't know when you're taking drugs, you don't know the consequences or the ripple effect.
Yeah.
But, you know, just bringing back to your own story, you said to us earlier on that you were a functioning addict for a long time. Will you explain what that is and what it was like for you?
Yeah, so I was a functional addict. I worked for a long, long time. I think we spoke, like, I worked in I had a job for 17 years in the graphics industry for a pharmaceutical company. And I remember my first day going into that job at 17 years of age, and I had tin foil and heroin in a John Player Blue box with me tutor and a couple of cigarettes. Like, I went in there doing heroin. 17 years later, when I left that job, that was the end of me, nearing the end of me. I was in there 17 years.
Same job.
Now, ironically, as I mentioned beforehand, some of the customers we had was Pinewood Healthcare. So I was designing the methadone labels. I was designing the anti-anxiety medication, sitting there absolutely dying for some Anxicam, and I'm looking at the bleeding labels all day, like, panic, the anxiety. I still struggle to sit on my computer for a few hours clicking on the mouse, because it's actually, I create an association of when I was sitting in that job suffering so badly with anxiety, just dying for the bell to go so I could actually go and do drugs. Like, it was horrific.
For me, right, if I was working, and there's stages in my life where I did work, but when I got paid, it would be a huge blow and I'd lose the job. And I know with heroin as well, like, fucking hell, enough is never enough, do you know? How did you find the balance, or how did you manage to maintain it for so long?
It was really weird. So it was like, it was a progression where, like, I lived with a delusion that I wasn't a real addict. And even though I was on a methadone program, I was a registered addict for 12 of those years. From 22, 23 until I was 35. So 13 of the years that I was in that job, I was a registered addict. So I'd be going to the chemist, drinking me methadone. I'd be going to the clinic and giving me urines to get me script. But I tried to believe I wasn't a real addict. And an element of not being a real addict, whatever the hell a real addict was, the transporting version of an addict, I tried to not limit my use, but I tried to not get too mental with it. So I would start the views. I'd get up in the morning, take a few tablets, do a few lines of gear. During lunchtime, do a few lines of gear. I tried to just keep the edge off until I got home from work. Now, when I got home from work, then there'd be loads of tablets. I'd do two bags of gear. I'd always be trying to keep a little bit for the next morning because I was so consumed with not being sick. And I always wanted to have drugs, but then I'd go on binges. Like, I'll never forget one time, me and my best mate, he's still in the depths of it, he is now, but like we laugh now, it's probably not even funny, but we call it a smackathon. So we pretended we went down.
That was like fun.
Yeah, we pretended to go down to Galway for the weekend. My man and I were going away, and I think we bought like about 500-600 quid's worth of gear, and we just stayed in the gaff for the weekend. The lines closed. Told all our mates we were in Galway, and just done a smackathon for the weekend. So there was mad excesses in some areas. And then, but it was just a slow build over time. And by the time I was hitting me late 20s, it was all getting really, really bad, really, really dark. And then by the time I was hitting me 30s, I was just consuming massive amounts of drugs. Coke was gone. I wasn't doing crack or coke. Crack wasn't really big on the scene. I was doing a little bit of that, but the coke, I wasn't doing coke anymore. It was all just built downers to numb the pain.
Yeah.
So gear wasn't really working for me anymore. That was the reality of, like, I was messing around. I had a chronic fear of needles, but I start injecting here and there, but it was never something I could do on my own all of the time. So I was lucky enough to stay away from consistent intravenous use.
Do you know, from all that smoking gear, like, because it was so consistent for so many years.
Yeah.
How did your body look? How did you physically look? And even your teeth?
Yeah.
You can see when someone's smoking gear, like, they lose.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
They lose respect for themselves in terms of how they look.
I didn't shower for 2 years. I often say that. In my 30s was a time when I didn't shower for 2 years. And I laugh about that. I remember reading in an article one day that Brad Pitt uses baby wipes on set. And I remember thinking, it's good enough for Brad, good enough for me. And I pretty much barely showered for 2 years. I did not shower for 2 years. That's a lie. I didn't brush my teeth for 2 years, but I barely showered for 2 years as well. And my teeth were in bits. I used to put tin foil on my teeth to stop it and collect the extra gear on the tin foil as well. So I'd have the teeth thing on me and I'd have the tour. But my teeth were in bits. I've gotten a lot of work done on my teeth to get them fixed up. But I remember saying it to the dentist and saying, how did I not lose my teeth? Especially with the methadone for so many years as well. I know it wasn't the sugary methadone, it was the green methadone. But he just says, thank your parents for that. You've good genetics. You're very lucky to have your teeth. Cool. But what it mostly done to me, the drugs, it looked like I was overweight. If anyone sees pictures of me back in the day, it looked like I was overweight. Just this bloat, because it was the benzos, the methadone. Yeah. I was drinking a lot of vodka as well, combining drugs just to numb feelings. So, and I had this real waxy kind of a look. I remember my sister was saying, like, it looked, if you touched off, you looked like you were in a wax museum. That sort of sweat, that layer of sweat that would be on your face.
My face was like, it felt like fucking foreskin. My skin was so fragile. And it was like that wax you're talking about. Like,
as if it would break away.
So fragile, so weak, fucking... not able to look after yourself, you know, no nutrition, pure neglect.
Yeah, well, I don't know what you ate, but for me, it was chicken kebabs and Monster Munch. That's what I used to eat. Chicken kebabs and Monster Munch. That was my go-to.
Adam and Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
You do. Yeah. The milk line the stomach.
Yeah.
How does someone hold down a job for 17 years in active addiction? And we know how active it was. And it's completely out of control. You know, maybe not for maybe from the 9 to 5, but when you go home, then you're at it for the night. And you still have to get up in the morning at 7 or whatever to get into work for 8. How does someone actually be able to keep a job? You obviously must have been punctual, you turned up, you got the job done, to say that they kept you on there.
The last year when they started looking into it, I was late 170 something times in the year, and he says, what is going on? So what happened was, my boss, my former boss, lovely woman, she really had me back, and she knew I had addiction issues. I had my first panic attack in the job and all, and I told her about my addiction issues. She knew I was on methadone. She was from a lovely area, but she just really tried to look after me with that. But I tried to get in on time. Do you know what the one thing was? I was very good at my job. I was very technically minded, and it was certain, we worked in the graphics department, and even though I was bloody strung out the bits, I was the only one that could do certain tasks within the job. So as bad as I was, my abilities were recognised, and people thought I was an alcoholic. That was the big one. Most people thought I was an alcoholic, and there was loads of boozers in the job. So they didn't want to be getting rid of the alcoholic to shine a light on them. So alcohol protected me in the job. But it got to the stage where it was just so bad. Like, we worked in the pharma industry, and I do corporate work, and I do these courses for the corporate industry. And I'm working for Sanofi at the moment. And I remember Sanofi, the company, coming to audit our jobs. They were doing an audit on our company to make sure everything was up to scratch. And the quality control manager used to say, she used to ring up ahead, says, can you hide Brian in the dark room?
Jesus.
So they'd hide me in the dark room so the customers wouldn't see me. That's how bad it got in the end. And there was just such love. It was like a family. It's the originals of the job. I was one of the originals. I mean, they looked after me, but it was a form of enabling. But it got to the stage where we merged with another company, and all these new people came in, and everyone was like, what's the story with your man? What's going on there? So he goes asleep. He's asleep half the time. What? They were like blown away. And all of a sudden, the light was shone on me, and the people that had grew up with me were like, oh my God, like, what have we allowed happen here? And I went in, I shouldn't be laughing at all these things, but it is funny. But I went in, the job were trying to get rid of me, and I was the factory manager and the other main man in the job. And I was called in for a meeting, and my two really good friends out of job who I worked with were also the father of the chapel and the shop steward. And we went into a meeting to save me job, because apparently I couldn't work anymore and I was going to sleep. And after the meeting at the table, I walked out and I says, lads, I think that went all right, did it? And he's looking at me, he says, Brian, you fell asleep. You fell asleep in the mean. Your head was on the table and we were all looking at each other. So I just goofed off, like, full of benzos, full of tablets. So that was the end. That was the end for me. I lost my job, lost everything, and it really went to crap after that.
Was that the end? Was that the demise then of like, because you know, didn't have any finances to be able to fund your habit anymore?
Yeah, and I was 50 grand in debt as well at that stage. And the problem was, I owed money to money lenders, credit union, banks, credit cards, drug dealers. There was just little bits of everything everywhere. And even drug dealers wouldn't give me drugs to sell to feed me habit anymore. I was too bad for them. You know, that way I was untrustworthy to them. So I got to the stage, I had no way of feeding me habit. I was on death's door, truly on death's door. I had nowhere to turn, nowhere to go. And that was the first time that I actually tried to get break free from addiction. And
that's your turning point.
That was the turning point. That was the complete turning point for me. And that was August 2013.
What age are you?
I was 35. And I had just, my nan had just died. It's brutal it was, because my nan had me back. She wouldn't let anyone, he looks great, wouldn't let anyone talk bad of me, and she never seen me in recovery, so I'm devastated with that. But I remember going to the clinic and says, look, I want to try to get clean. And he says, right, we'll try to get you into a detox. But because I was taking so many benzos, he says, you have to get off the benzos first. Because I wanted to go to the lantern, which you had to be down to 40 or 60 mils, I can't remember what it was. And I had to be off benzos. So I says, I'll get off, I'll stop doing the benzo. And he says, you can't, you'll have to do a benzo detox because you're taking so many for so many years. And I had to wait 8 weeks. I think it was St. Francis Farm. They're going to send me somewhere else to do a benzo detox or a different detox. And I says, I can't wait 8 weeks. I says, I have to do this now. And he says, you'll kill yourself. You could kill yourself. Don't do it. Well, I went against her advice, and I wouldn't advise anyone to do this because it did nearly kill me.
And you can die from cold turkey, from benzos and alcohol as well.
Yeah, alcohol as well, through the seizures.
Yeah.
And I call it 2 days into that home detox, not only the most painful night of my life, it was the most important night of my life. And I woke up, blood everywhere. I did have a convulsive seizure, and I split my tongue through the convulsions. I split my tongue down the middle, blood all over the place. And that was the point for me. I landed in the hospital later that night. My family got me off to the hospital, but they rang an ambulance. And I was so broken, emotionally, mentally and physically broken by that moment, that something just shifted inside me. I think that was they often say, like, I didn't go down the fellowship route, but they often say it's a spiritual solution. But I think I was absolutely broken to the core, and I was a crack at the ego, some kind of spiritual thing where something had shifted inside me. And I don't know what it was. I just knew I couldn't use anymore, but I was so broken. But by the time, 4 weeks later, by the time I actually landed in an opiate detox to get off methadone, there was like this energy inside of me that I might actually have a life again. I think something has changed. It was like I was looking through the world through a different lens, still terrified, still afraid. Like, I remember being asked to do mindfulness for the first time and saying, focus on your breath. And I said, I'm afraid of my breath. I can't focus on my breath. And he says, do it through the nostrils. And I done mindfulness through the nostrils for the first time. Cold air going in, hot air going out. And it was like a miracle. I was like, oh my God, I can focus on that bodily sensation. This is like a miracle. Sounds bizarre saying that, but it was like a miracle. And I start reading about psychology in there for the first time. I start reading books about Eastern philosophy, meditating for the first time, talking to a psychologist for the first time. And there was just this shift, and it was like this intense hunger to learn about the human mind, to learn about what is going on in our bodies? Why are we so broken? How can I help other people to feel what I'm feeling now? Because even though I was in the height of a heroin detox, I just felt incredible, felt horrific physically, and the fever and all of those elements towards it as well. But there was this weird, I don't like the word spiritual, but this weird energetic shift inside of me that if I could go back to any time in my life to relive for 24 hours, I would go back to the 2 days before my first day clean. I was up one night at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was just blown away by all these books. Maybe it was a manic episode, I don't know, but it shifted something inside me that I could go and have a career in this stuff, and it set the tone.
Is there any psychological theory or perspective on that, what we would call spiritual awakening, that shift of the ego where the compulsion and craving to use is lifted and the frame of mind around addiction and recovery shifts? You could be 10, 15 years struggling to try and get it, and then something happens and it's like, Timmy had it, I had it, you was very articulately put it there as well. Some people don't get it.
Yeah.
No, is there any explanation for it?
There's not really, right? Because when you look at change, and I've sort of asked a couple of really big experts, Stephen Porges of those polyvagal theory. Yeah. I got on a call with him recently, and we chatted about that. And when you look at the biology of that, it changes over time. Same with habits and behavioural change, it's over time. But a spiritual shift is just this light bulb comes on and something shifts. And we were sort of chatting earlier on about Anthony DeMello's book Awareness, and we were touching on that. And he talks about the addict knows that the drugs are killing them. They know heroin's not good for them. They know alcohol's not good, but they're not aware. And once you become aware, everything changes. And for me, it was like the lights came on. I was like, what was I doing? And there was one little theory in psychology that I seen. It's called a pivotal learning experience, where it's like all of the lights come on at the same time and you connect the dots of loads of things, but one little thing triggers all of those things. Now, I think that's a psychological way of explaining something that can't really be explained.
And I can completely understand that. I just want to come in and just give my little bit on it. So if you look at all the different people, look at us, like something happened in our lives for us to be sitting here away from alcohol and drugs and that lifestyle. And you look at the likes of Eckhart Tolle, right? He had an awakening. It was completely different.
Yeah.
Something different happened to him. But if you look at what we all had in common, we all had a lot of pain, emotional pain.
Yeah.
We were all at the end. Now, there was bucket loads of different stuff that we could have easily stopped on, but we weren't ready.
Yeah.
You see? And it's just that timing. There's no explanation for it.
Yeah.
There's no explanation for it. Do you know, later on in life, you look back at your life and you ask yourself, how in the name of God didn't I die then? Or then? Or then? Or then? Maybe the answer is this. Maybe the answer is you weren't supposed to die.
Hmm.
Maybe the answer is you're supposed to be here doing the work you're doing now. You know? And sometimes it doesn't work out like that for some people. And because they're not as fortunate as us here. And we've something really grateful to be grateful for, and we're sitting here, we're able to share our stories, and maybe the answer is pain. When you hit your boiling point in pain, you get a glimpse of awareness in your life where you look at it and you just become aware for the first time. This is my experience.
Yeah.
You become aware for the first time, you stop fighting, the mind is clear, and this voice comes in and says, you can't, what's your life going to be like? You can't do this no more. You cannot do this no more. And that is the starting point, everything else. You can't look back in your life and say, why didn't I die here, or dear, dear, dear. It's not till you do the work in yourself and you get some clarity as years go on, you start to understand this stuff. And that's my little bit of an explanation. I don't know, is it the same as everybody else's? But for me, I hit my boiling point in pain, loneliness, fear, guilt, sadness. I hit it. I was on my own. I wanted to take my own life. And just, I gave up. And when I gave up, the voice came in.
That's
then.
It. It's the giving up.
Do you know?
It's the giving up. It's the stopping the fight. That was the point. That was the one point that I remember lying in the hospital and I thought it was brain damaged. I had this experience where I was looking at this fire extinguisher hanging on the wall. I saw it was slumped over and I just ended up just staring at this fire extinguisher on the wall. And I had this realisation that I couldn't label it. I was like, what's that? And I couldn't label it. And I started looking around the rest of the room. It was like my brain wasn't working. And I says, you've destroyed your brain. You're fucked. Game over. That's brain damage. And I remember just thinking, I can't do this anymore. I can't fight this anymore. I give up. And I think that was the moment, that exact moment, I just lay back down and I felt a sense of peace come over me instead of just being overwhelmed because I thought it was brain damage. And for me, that giving up was monstrous.
For when I was in the detox, which was just only a few months before yourself, just to get into the detox and to have a bed and be able to put your clothes into a wardrobe and all these things, you know, like basic needs met for the first time, and getting the realisation then, like you're talking about, a few different things joining the dots at the same time, coming together. Maturity, consequences from addiction, loneliness, pain, shame, guilt, looking around, like, using with people that you would never have associated with if there weren't drugs involved, being around situations that made you feel very uncomfortable, but you know, you've nowhere else to go or nobody else will take you in. This type of... Well, I remember being up in the detox and... there was a lot of Dalmain came in. Now, Dalmain aren't the nice tablets. They had an awful taste. But you take them, you know.
Yeah.
It was my first time ever refusing drugs in there.
Wow.
And I it was like that. It was that surrender. I was like, you know what? I could take the drugs, try and pass the urine, try and weave my way and connive my way around it. I said, but that doesn't work out for me no more. And I'm just going to take myself away from all that negativity now. And I'm just going to remove and... give up. I don't know what, I'm just going to give this my best shot now. If I get thrown out of here, there's nowhere to go. I've burned all my bridges. I've tried all the ways and means of using. I won't use D-Dens, I use Annex, I won't inject, I'll smoke, I won't drink vodka, I'll drink lager. It didn't matter what it was, it always ended up in the same place, you know?
Yeah.
But that's surrendering. Right off of me, maturity was a big part of mine. It was like getting a little bit older, and having, you know, exhausted all the ways and means of using and coming to the realisation that this is the end of the road for you. And sometimes it might happen a little bit later for yourself. To me, it's a little bit around the same time as me.
Yes. Yeah.
But the point I was trying to make really is, once you're alive, it cannot, like, your turning point might be next week, but you always go again. And you don't ever just accept and give up.
Yeah.
Because it can happen for you later or earlier.
Yeah. And I think the key point is, like, and I'm thinking of our three stories here, like, we were three, it sounds like we were three hopeless cases. And I often get people coming to me saying, there's just no hope, there's just no hope, there's always hope. It's very hard to see. But, you know, just as you said, it could be just around the corner. It's like the perfect storm of lots of these things happening at the same time. And it's just having faith that there could be hope for other people as well.
Do you know, a lot of people, when they come into recovery and they feel like that they have a lot of energy and time to catch up and stuff like that, and they run with the education thing. Myself and Timmy did, so did you.
Yeah.
What was your education journey? What did you start out with? We know you finished with the PhD. What did you start out with, little courses first? Or?
No, so I basically very, coming from such a long addiction, I was full of ego in terms of seeing the world from my perspective only. So I says, I want to learn about the human mind. I'm going to do a degree in psychology. So I thought psychology was going to be all about addiction. For some bizarre reason, I thought I was going to be learning loads about addiction in psychology. There wasn't a snippet about addiction in psychology. It was all about statistics. Yeah. I was very lucky that I have a bit of a matsy head and I enjoy statistics. But something that we touched on, you mentioned unmet needs. And I think when you break free from addiction, and I think one of the things to have a successful recovery, whatever that actually looks like, for me, it was for education, but it helped me to meet my unmet needs because I love learning and it allowed me to connect with other people as well. I really love connecting with new people. So those unmet needs made it easier for me because I was meeting those needs that I had. And all of a sudden then it was like this reinforcement thing where I was getting rewarded by academia because I found I was actually quite good at that, and I was catching it and I was learning it, and that sort of set me on another road as well. So really the whole journey for me, well, academia, it was psychology first, and then that sort of brought me away from addiction, because I says, right, it's not all about addiction, it's about the human mind. And I learned more about my experience. So I didn't really have an addiction problem, I had a mental health problem. So I went down that lines, and I often say, like, I nearly switched addictions. I don't like using that terminology, but I was obsessed about learning. And that obsession got me to score really high marks in psychology because, again, ego, tint of ego as well. I wanted to be the best. I wanted to be the best in psychology. But that sort of drive and that competitiveness really pushed me on. And I got a scholarship then for Trinity College to do the PhD. And I tried to redirect myself then in the world of addiction. Like, my PhD was looking at mindfulness interventions for people in early recovery coming out of a treatment facility. And that research got ruined by COVID, as I mentioned previously. But then I started looking into other models. We were looking at impulsivity and wanting more and people in addiction. So my whole research journey then went back into addiction circles then as well. But really, again, looking at the drivers of addiction rather than the addiction itself.
Would you be interested in finishing out the first piece of research you did?
No, first of all, I haven't got the money was, so it was basically a funded PhD, and it's a terrible shame. So we needed about 65-70 people to go through the intervention, and like, it was a lot of work. So I got a guy that was doing mindfulness interventions, 8-week mindfulness intervention, and we had 30 people gone through that intervention, like 30 people in waves of 10. Loads of, I think we'd 40 actually gone through. So we'd spent about 30 grand paying all the people to go through to deliver the interventions. And it's basically the amount of time is just not feasible. I'm not in academia anymore, so I'm not doing research anymore. Only a little bit, I don't do much. But it's not feasible, and it's a terrible shame.
What's your life like now?
My life today is, I'm incredibly happy, and I think that's the most important thing to say. Incredibly happy, incredibly grateful, mostly for the people and the connections that I have in my life. And I have a constant battle of trying to spend more time with the people that I love and the people that are important to me versus my work, because I love my work, which is a a great complaint. It's like having three strikers and I can only play two. Mm. So I love my work, and I'm not giving out about that, but it's finding out what's important. So I do a lot of work in the corporate world. I do a lot of courses, a lot of keynote talks. I also do a lot of work in schools as well. So I ran a mentorship program for a school in Talladega for the last 2 years. It was incredibly rewarding. So for me going forward, I was probably doing like a couple of hours a week in this for the school work, and then the rest in the corporate world, trying to build a business for myself. And over the next 5 to 10 years, what I want to do is to create a business where I'm making money so I can give more time to the skills, more time to kids, and less time in the workplace. So really like a Robin Hood kind of model, get paid money to give back to society. Yeah.
So tell me this, okay, when you stopped using, you came out of the hospital, okay, there's 10 years then of recovery, you got straight into education straight away. Okay, so me, I went to therapy for many, many years. I went to AA. I'd done lots of different things. James would be very more intellectual, and he was able to grasp information a lot easier than I would. So I had to do a lot of meditation. What was your go-to to help you with the trauma that you drank, you drugged on? What were you using now to be able to help you to heal yourself internally?
Mindfulness was one element of it, a big element of it. Good nutrition and exercise. And they were the three biggest components of the self-healing process for me.
Counselling? Did you go to REA? Did you hit any of those services?
I didn't go to counselling. I was nearly obsessed with the psychology of the mind. And it made sense. And I just wanted to learn about it. So I when I came out of treatment, I was on this, they call it the pink fluffy cloud, and I stayed on that for a long time, but I was disconnected from my emotions, selectively disconnected from negative emotions. I jumped on those positive emotions, and it was weird the way I was able to do that. And it was only in the latter years that I really connected with my own emotions fully, and I started really feeling the pain that I caused my family, and then I start suffering in terms of feeling the depth of those emotions, that I really start creating deep connections with people. But the process, it was like my brain was protecting me from going there early doors, because I don't think I would have been able to cope with it, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
And it was only after 4 or 5 years in a slower process that I was able to really go through the whole process.
You started to really internally heal then.
Yeah.
And that's a very fair point what you just made there, that for the first 4 or 5 years, it was like unconsciously your body and your mind were protecting you because you weren't ready
to go there
to this area. So you were actually busy anyway, getting an education and learning. And we were speaking beforehand, me and you, we were talking about the mind-body connection, you know, through maybe memories and how your thought will bring up a memory. And then that memory is probably connected to emotion, maybe fear or shame, guilt, whatever it may be. Could be happy too, or grief or whatever. And what happens then is you feel that emotion in the body, and then the mind will snowball to justify the way you're feeling. It will think more shameful thoughts, more thoughts to make you more fearful. And that's how it is. You started to learn all this stuff early in recovery, and it started to make sense. And with the mindfulness then that you were using at the same time, it was allowing you during the mindfulness, when all this emotional stuff, because listen, this is very, very fair to make this point. When people who have had a lot of trauma in their lives, or just normal people in general, when they want to sit and do mindfulness, everything comes up here. Yeah. Everything that the mind can possibly bring up, negative, critical stuff, will come in. And at the beginning, it'll say, oh God, I can't do this, because when I'm sitting down, all this stuff is coming up. It's about letting go. It's about giving up and stop fighting. It's about stop fighting all this stuff and feel it. And it's about allowing it in. And there's so much great information out there to be able to do this stuff. We were talking about Dr. Joe Dispenza. He was the guy that really helped me, you know, and your own kind of way of getting to where you are today was the academic and learning and be able to put it into action. You know, what would you recommend for somebody else? There's so many different variations. Would you recommend in somebody just finding out what works for them?
I would say keep it simple. Make it easy. They're two of the, and you have to enjoy it. If you're pushing against something and you don't enjoy it, you're not going to continue. It's not going to be sustainable. So if you absolutely hate mindfulness, it's not for you. Probably just not for you. Yeah, I enjoyed exercise, so I went with that. I enjoyed mindfulness, even though I found it, I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. There was something about it grabbed me in, and I done that for a while. But I wouldn't practice mindfulness every day now. I'm more inclined to do breath work now instead because I enjoy that more. So what I would say for people is take baby steps. Don't try to do like an hour a day because you just won't be able to sustain that. Baby steps, do something that's sustainable and try to find something that you kind of enjoy that you can keep doing on a long-term basis. That is really the key.
Yeah. If people want to contact you to give you feedback or say hi or book you for a corporate, how can they do that?
Best place to go is the website. I'm actually going to have my new, it's a website there the last few years, but my new website should be up now in about 2 weeks, new fancy website. So it's brianpenny.com or Instagram, it's brianpenny78 there to two, definitely the two best places to go.
Description is
super stuff.
Thank
super
you for
stuff.
Time, Brian. It's been a
love to chat, lads. Absolutely. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll see everybody next week.
God bless.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.